Noi grins. I can't wait for Billy to come back so I can show him. Jules smiles softly. She stares down at her hands and squeezes them into fists. Will you let Madrigal do the unbinding? Arsinoe asks. Do you think I should? I don't know. Joseph doesn't think so. He says it's too dangerous, that the binding might be the only thing holding back the curse. But I keep on thinking of something that Luke said, that there must be a reason why the goddess put me near you. Like I could be strong, like I could help you win. You don't need the war gift to make you strong, Arsinoe says. You already are. Is there anything else that Kate and Madrigal aren't telling us? Anything else that the Oracle said? Something that might help? No. She said I was Legion cursed with war and they paid her to keep the secret. I think it was fairly simple. They smile at each other a bit uncomfortably. Arsinoe does not know what Jules will decide, but she does wish that it was someone other than Madrigal who held the key to the binding. Ellis knocks and pokes his head in with Jake, who gives a bright bark.
Up and dressed, he says. We have suitors to prepare for.
Suitors, Jules says and grins. Arsinoe pulls her light summer quilt up over her head. She had been so focused on Mirabella that she completely forgot about Tommy Stratford and Michael Percy. Wake me when it's over, she says with a moan.
Well, if that won't get you up, how about the fact that on the way back from the southern field I ran into Madge, and she said that Billy's mainland boat put in this morning?
Billy arrives at the Malone house just after noon, as Arsinoe is walking her bear in the far west part of the yard.
Well, well, says Billy. Joseph told me it was true. I almost didn't believe him.
Arsinoe grins. He is such a welcome sight. She had not realized how much she had been waiting for him, how much she missed him while he was away. His name is Braddock, she says.
Braddock the bear. Seems fitting enough. Is he safe?
Arsinoe strokes Braddock's large forehead. She has been with him since the morning, getting him used to the smells and sounds of people. The Malones are naturalists, and their gift puts the bear at ease. But giftless folk will see him at the feast as well, and clueless mainland suitors besides. No matter how docile the bear seems, she must take extra care. With his sweet face shoved into her hip, it is easy to forget that theirs is a bond of low magic, not of familiars. He is safe for now, she says. He's stuffed full of ripened apples and striped bass, plus one of the children who came round to spy on him. Billy cautiously slides his fingers into the bear's brown fur.
He's, Billy says and swallows, softer than I thought. And he doesn't smell like the last one.
The last one was old, diseased. It was a mistake. Or maybe it was the price for this one.
Low magic, right? You never know the price until you've paid it.
Arsinoe shoves him playfully and Braddock raises his head. What would you know about it, mainlander?
Less than nothing, Billy says.
Then his eyes lose focus on the ground.
I have some news.
News. I'm beginning to hate that word. It is never anything good anymore. Billy does not smile or tell her to stop being so glum, but it cannot be so bad when he has just returned.
I'm afraid I've been sold to the Westwoods, he says.
What?
I've been appointed Queen Mirabella's royal taster, my father's punishment for refusing to take part in the courting. I'm leaving for Rowanth tonight on pain of disinheritance.
He smiles ruefully.
Always on pain of disinheritance. But he let me come back here to tell you. He gave me that, at least.
But, Arsinoe sputters, you can't.
I must.
At her anxious tone, Braddock bobs his head and wanders away. Junior, don't be an idiot. You can't be her taster. Doesn't your father understand the danger? She... Katarine is already sending poison to Rolanth. One of Mirabella's maids has already died in a poisoned dress.
It was not a poisoned dress, Billy says. It was a poisoned glove. And she did not die. They cut off her hand in time. They didn't even know if it would have killed her or if Katarine is only playing.
The Aarons do not play, Arsinoe insists. And how do you know all that?
My father discussed it with the Westwoods at length.
Her brow furrows and he smiles charmingly and slips his hand onto the back of her neck, beneath the fall of her hair. That stupid mainland bluster. But she cannot seem to move away. Do all mainlanders think themselves immortal? Or is it just you?
I will be perfectly safe. My father wouldn't put me at risk. And when he's done being angry, I'll come back to you, I promise. In the meantime, I can be your ears and eyes on Mirabella.
He caresses her mask with his thumb.
I heard what happened in the woods. You shouldn't have gone up against her like that, you great half-wit.
She pushes his hand away from her mask. Are you sure that your father wouldn't make some other bargain? He is always in Indrid Down with the Aarons.
He likes Indrid Down. It's more like home. Civilized. He's looking forward to ousting the Aarons when you are queen.
She rolls her eyes and he laughs, trying to cheer her.
Don't be so worried. I'm his only son. And where I come from, that means something.
Can't anyone change your mind?
No one,
he says.
Not even you.
So you'll leave? When?
We're sailing for Rolanth today.
But you've only just returned. Everything inside her is suddenly heavy. She takes a clumsy half-step forward and throws her arms around Billy's neck. After an initial oof of surprise, he holds her tight.
Don't be daft,
he says into her hair.
No matter how far I go, I'm still your person. We stand together now. We are together now, aren't we?
Are we? She asks. He kisses her forehead and her cheek. He kisses her shoulder, still too nervous to kiss her properly, and that is her fault. Then he gently removes her arms and turns to walk away. Billy? She calls out, and he stops. Why did you choose me, instead of one of my sisters?
Because I saw you first, he says and winks. I'll be back soon. But, just in case I die, I want you to remember that you could have kissed me that day in the meadow.
Jules and Joseph load barrels of ale onto the back of an ox cart. It will be driven over the hill to the apple orchard northeast of the Malone house, where the feast to welcome the suitors will be held.
You're strong for someone so small,
Joseph says, as they load the last one. He wipes sweat from his brow.
What is that? She asks.
A compliment wrapped in an insult? He laughs, and they move into the shade on the back steps of the Lion's Head. Camden stretches out at their feet on the cool stone pavement, and Jules leans forward to scratch her belly.
I can't believe that Billy's father is sending him to be a taster, Jules says. It feels like we shouldn't let him go, or that he should refuse.
He never refuses his father, says Joseph, and cocks his head thoughtfully. No one ever refuses his father. All that time I lived with him, I only saw folk kiss his arse and tell him what he wanted to hear. He's used to getting the things that he wants.
He shrugs.
I wonder what that's like.
It doesn't sound like much to me, says Jules. Sounds like arse kissing and lies. One of us ought to go with Billy, to ease Arsinoe's mind, if nothing else.
I'm going with him, Jules, he says,
and she looks at him in shock. I didn't mean you, and I was really only saying it to be kind.
I'm not staying, he says, half smiling at her outburst. Just going to get him settled in, make sure everything is on the up and up, like you said, so Arsinoe won't worry.
She'll worry anyway. Jules crosses her arms. Will you see Mirabella? Climb into her bed, maybe?
That's part of the reason I'm going. To see her, not the bed part.
he adds when Jules's fists come up.
Why do you need to see her?
To tell her that it's over. To make sure she knows.
She doesn't need to know, does she?
Jules asks, knowing how mean it sounds but unable to keep quiet.
It was never anything to start with.
Mirabella will die or marry a suitor. You were never an option.
Jules.
Joseph takes her face in his hands and kisses her.
I love you. What I did was wrong, but I wronged her, too. This was my fault. She didn't know about you until it was too late.
Jules sighs.
Go, then.
So you trust me? She turns and looks squarely into his handsome, storm-blue eyes.
Not one bit.
The suitors arrive. Indrid Down. The Highburn Hotel is the finest in the capital, a tall, imposing rectangle of gray brick and gold-gilded rainspouts fashioned into the likenesses of falcon heads, close enough to the Volroy to cast its morning shadow into the western gardens. The black and white flags above the doors have been replaced with pure black ones, embossed with coiled snakes and poisonous flowers, a clear announcement that the Poisoner Queen is in attendance. In the grand ballroom, Catherine sits restlessly between Natalia and Nicholas Martell, as he oohs and ahs at the finery. It is nothing new for her. She has been to the Highburn many times, with Natalia for tea and for other banquets through the years. Personally, she has always thought the place smelled too old, as if it were rotting beneath its carpets. But today they have opened the doors and windows, so at least she can enjoy the lilac wafting from the Volroy's courtyard fences.
Have you heard the news from Highgate? Renata Hargrove asks.
Natalia arranged the seating differently for the suitors' feast, more intimately, around curving tables covered in deep red cloth. To Catherine's great delight, it meant she was able to place Genevieve nearly all the way across the room.
What news is that? Natalia asks.
Apparently the elemental called not one but two storms, with fierce lightning and fires with smoke that was visible for miles.
Yet the naturalist lives, says Lucian Marlowe, the only non-Aran male on the Black Council.
A pity her carriage was only a decoy. We could have used the rain.
Natalia sips her tainted wine and the guests chuckle.
Though with any luck she will kill the naturalist, and we will never have to close our windows against the smell of bear.
But what fun is that for our Queen Catherine?
Lucian says and laughs. Catherine ignores them and leans toward Nicholas.
You must think us awful, with all this talk of death.
Not at all, he says in his soft accent. I have been educated in the ways of the queens, and I have seen death and dying on the battlefield. Coups in my country cost tens of thousands of lives. Your ascension years seem civilized in comparison.
You sound very certain, Catherine says. But your eyes are nervous, perhaps even afraid.
Only of accidentally eating something that was not meant for my plate.
Nicholas smiles and looks down as though to guard it. The feast is agave noir, but not of the scope of the quickening. Each dish is served as a separate course, and all of the poisoners in attendance partake, not only the queen. Catherine pushes her fork into a green salad dotted with poisonous mushrooms and adjusts the itchy gloves on her hands. Underneath, her skin is healing from a rubbing of dwarf nettle. The combination of healing scabs and sweat is making her want to scratch her skin off.
Before the Beltane festival, I thought watching agave noir would be vulgar. But afterward,
he looks up at her from beneath his fall of gold hair.
There is something alluring about it, that you may eat something that I will never be able to taste.
Shall I describe it to you?
Do you think you could?
I do not know.
She looks down at the mushrooms, their bright red caps spotted with white.
Much of what we eat is bitter or has little taste, but there is something in the sensation of it
It is like eating power. She stabs a bit onto her fork and pops it into her mouth.
And it does not hurt that our cooks drown everything in butter.
Nicholas laughs. His voice is not deep. Indeed, Natalia's voice is deeper. But it is pleasant.
It must be more than that, he says. Every poisoner here has turned their nose up as my dishes go by.
He glances about the room, and Katerine raises her eyebrows at his plate, a shallow bowl of chilled summer soup. Only he, giftless Renata Hargrove, and war-gifted Margaret Boleyn are eating that, and they all have the sense to pretend they are not hungry.
Do not pay them any attention, Katerine says. Poisoners are always that way about untainted food.
She reaches up and touches the flowers of the centerpiece and the towers of shining fruit.
They see it as inelegant, no matter how much silver they pile it upon or how much sponge sugar they hide it under.
Nicholas reaches out as well, and their fingers touch. He seizes the opportunity and takes her hand to press it firmly to his lips, so firmly that she is sure to feel it even through the gloves. Katerine does feel it. It shocks her just how much, and for a moment, Peter flashes into her mind, the memory of him suddenly strong enough to make her heart pound. She clenches her teeth and takes a breath. She refuses to think of Peter that way. Peter, who tried to murder her. She touches her face. Her cheeks are flushed.
But Nicholas will think it is because of his kiss.
There is such finery here, Nicholas says, but less of a heartbeat than at the Beltane Festival. Those nights beside the fires were so exciting, watching you through the flames, looking up at you from the sand. Will there be other festivals like that?
The next festival is for Midsummer, Katerine says, and coughs when her voice trembles. Celebrated across the island, of course, but really it is a naturalist affair of harvest and bounty. Then there is the Reaping Moon in autumn, though the elementals claim that through fires and chilled winds.
Which festival is the Poisoner's Festival? Nicholas asks.
Every festival, Natalia answers from Katerine's other side.
She should have known that Natalia would be listening.
At every festival there is a feast, Natalia explains. And every feast is for the poisoners.
The main course is served, a poisoned hog with a bright spring pear stuffed into its mouth after roasting. The servers bring it first to Katerine and Natalia's table to carve her the choicest bits, along with spoonfuls of orange squash sweetened with molasses and arsenic. The hog is delicious, juicy and robust. The seared bird on Nicholas's plate looks shrunken and sad in comparison. After the meal, Katerine leads her suitor onto the floor to dance.
I can't believe how well you are, Nicholas whispers, gazing at her in awe. There was so much poison. Enough to kill a man twice your size.
Enough to kill 20, Katerine corrects him, smiling.
But do not worry, Nicholas.
I have been eating poison since I was a child. Now, I am practically made of it.
Roland. Mirabella turns back and forth in front of the mirror with a pained expression as Sarah and the priestesses adjust the fall of her dress.
It is so thin in places, Mirabella says, studying a transparent spot near her hip.
The gown is fashioned from gauzy material, overlaid and wrapped around itself. It is light as air and moves in the breeze.
It is beautiful, Elizabeth assures her.
Just the thing to welcome a suitor in, says Bree.
William Chatworth Jr. is not here as a suitor. He is here as a prisoner. Everyone knows he has already chosen Arsinoe. This feast is a farce. Sarah fastens a necklace around Mirabella's throat. It is the one she selected for Beltane, with the obsidian beads and gems that burn like fire.
Boys' minds are changeable, she says, and taps the gems. This will remind him of your dance.
His eye was on you then, no matter what he says about the naturalist. With an impish grin, Bree bumps Mirabella aside and turns before the mirror.
I cannot wait for this feast. Stewed apples and pork, berry tartlets, all this business of poison and tasters. I'm so afraid of my plate most days that I barely manage a mouthful.
She points to a gap between her dress and her armpit.
Look at this bodice. My breasts have shrunk.
Bree, Elizabeth says and giggles.
They have not. Easy for you to say with the pair that you have. If they were not trapped under temple robes, no one would look at me twice.
She swishes her skirt back and forth. Despite her words, the dress is very becoming, embroidered with bright blue hydrangeas.
And what young man do you have your eye on now, daughter? Sarah asks.
Mrs. Warren's glass-making apprentice, Bree replies. The tawny-headed one, with good shoulders and freckles.
She turns.
Mira, if we fall in love, you must promise to appoint him to your royal guard, and then you must promise to get rid of him when we fall out of it.
Bree, Elizabeth objects.
She can't dismiss someone just because you've finished with them. If you turn around one day and find that Mira's guard is filled with your old lovers, then it will be your own fault.
Mirabella tries to smile. They have worked hard to cheer her since Arsinoe and her bear escaped in the Ashburn Woods. Mirabella had searched and searched, but it was as if her sister and the bear had vanished.
There will be whispers, Mirabella murmurs. They are saying I ran home with my tail tucked between my legs.
But we know the truth, Elizabeth protests. It was Arsinoe who ran, not you.
Arsinoe had run. But why? The bear had caught Mirabella completely by surprise. It could have torn her wide open. She does not understand why it did not, why Arsinoe did not fight back.
The pavilion in Moorgate Park has been decorated with wreaths of flowers and long, trailing white and blue ribbons. The temple means to present William Chatworth Jr. to her there, as though he is a gift.
So many people have come, Mirabella whispers, as their coach draws to a halt. All of Roland must have emptied, from the sheep farms in the south to the northern stalls at Penman Market. Mirabella takes a deep breath. The air smells of baked apple pies and fragrant spiced smoke from the roasting fires.
Mirabella! Queen Mirabella has arrived!
Those near to the coach rush toward it. Mirabella, Bree, and Elizabeth get out and are quickly jostled into the center of 9 guardian priestesses. Some in the crowd are into their cups and push too close.
Get back!
Bree shouts, as the priestesses grasp the handles of their serrated knives.
We should have brought Roe, Elizabeth says.
Roe is with Luca, Mirabella replies.
And besides, Bree adds, who likes to bring Roe anywhere?
But Elizabeth is right. If Roe were there, they would not have to worry about trouble from the crowd.
Do you hear that? Elizabeth mutters.
Mirabella does not hear anything except the noise of the people and the music from the players beside the pavilion.
Hear what, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth cranes her neck toward the green-leafed branches casting shade onto the path.
It is Pepper, she whispers. He's agitated. He recognizes someone.
I think I know who, Bree says.
Beside the fountain, Luca and Rose stand at the head of a band of priestesses. Kneeling at their feet, his head down so she can only see the top of his sandy hair is the suitor, William Chatworth Jr. And to his right is Joseph Sandrin. Mirabella wants to shout, but she does not react. She has been raised a queen and feels every eye on her. She cannot ask what Joseph is doing there. She cannot even reach out to squeeze her friend's hands.
Queen Mirabella, William says. I have come to serve.
You are most welcome, comes her distant reply.
William raises his eyes, and she forces herself to smile. Has Joseph come to stay? Is this the way he is found to be near her?
Come, Mira,
Bree whispers, and escorts her to the banquet table. Elizabeth bows and leaves to dine with her fellow priestesses. They seat Joseph on the other side of William Chatworth, who is seated to Mirabella's left. At her right, High Priestess Luca signals the musicians to play, and dancers and jugglers fill the space in the grass before the table. When a novice priestess brings Mirabella the first cut from the haunch of a roasted boar, Chatworth takes her knife and fork before she can even touch them.
Not yet, my queen, he says. This is my lot, to chew and swallow and see if I will die so you won't.
He takes a little of the meat and a section of apple pastry. Then he washes it all down with wine from a goblet. Mirabella waits. He drums his fingers.
No cramps, no burning, no blood from my eyes.
Do you think it's safe then, William?
Call me Billy, he says. And yes, I think it's safe. Safer anyway than what you did to Arsinoe in the forest.
Mirabella's eyes flash to his. They are squinted at the corners as though smiling, but that is not real. Underneath, they are hard as stone. There is no suitable apology for that, she says, so I will make none.
Good. I would have spat it back in your face.
May I have my fork now, Billy?
No.
He nods out toward the crowd, where people eat roasted boar and smoked fish off trenchers of bread. Dancing and laughing, and watching the royal table from the sides of their eyes.
We ought to give them a proper show. Isn't that what they expect? A love story for their queen?
He cuts a bit of meat and skewers it onto her fork. He offers it to her with his hand on the back of her chair, doting, as though feeding her sweets with his fingers. When she eats it, the people cheer.
There now, Billy says. That's better,
even though you were hesitant.
Did you think I might push the fork into your throat? Every one of these barbaric priestesses would be on me the moment I did.
But your death would serve Arsinoe, so perhaps you will still risk it.
Things aren't that bad yet, Queen Mirabella.
She tries to see around him to Joseph, but he is turned away, conversing with Ro of all people. No one seems to be listening. No one is hearing the things that Billy is saying to her. Sarah is talking with Luca. Even Bree is distracted, calling out to a boy with tawny hair.
This is how it will be, Billy says, his voice low. I will taste for you, and I will smile. I will appease my father.
He feeds her another bite of sweet apples.
And I will be back with my Arsinoe before she can even miss me.
Wolf Spring. I'm not wearing that, Arsinoe says. Madrigal sighs and drops the long black dress onto Arsinoe's bed.
It's their first time meeting you. You could wear a dress just once.
Arsinoe turns to her mirror and adjusts the cuffs on her black shirt. She straightens the mask on her face. I haven't worn a dress since I was 6 years old. It was half the reason I was crying when they came to take us from the Black Cottage. She holds her hands out.
Well, how do I look?
Madrigal raises her eyebrows.
Oh, who cares anyway? Arsinoe snaps. You're in a foul mood, and you haven't even seen them yet.
Tommy Stratford and Michael Percy, Arsinoe grumbles, as she strips off her vest and throws it aside.
Perhaps another. The pinstriped one that Luke made.
She looks at her frowning reflection, at the bit of her soft pink scar peeking out from beneath the red and black of the mask.
Just what is the punishment, she asks, if Braddock accidentally eats them both?
It's not wise to joke about such things.
I wish Billy was here.
If he was, there would be a fight, Madrigal says, and Arsinoe hides a smile.
Well, if you will not wear this, maybe I can get it on to Jules.
It will be longer. She bends to pick up the dress, and something small and dark falls out of the green sash at her waist.
What is that? Arsinoe asks.
Madrigal picks it up quickly and tucks it away.
It's nothing, she says.
But Arsinoe has done enough low magic to recognize the cords they use to collect blood.
It's not your blood, Madrigal assures her.
Not even I would dare to use that.
Besides, for this kind of spell, it's better to use your own.
What type is that? But Arsinoe already knows. The length of cord was tied around a familiar gold ring. She hopes she is wrong, but it looked just like a ring that Matthew gave to Kara a long time ago.
Only a charm? Madrigal replies and avoids her eyes.
How did you even get it? Did you go through her things? I thought she'd have taken it with her to the Black Cottage.
Well, she didn't. She gave it back to him, and what does it matter?
Madrigal goes to the window and looks out, where down in the yard Braddock is bonding with Camden and Jules.
It is almost time to go.
Don't change the subject, Arsinoe says, and Madrigal whirls.
Kara isn't here, she hisses.
So why should he still love her? Why shouldn't he love me?
Because it's ugly, what you've done.
Have you done it all along? Is that why he came to you in the first place?
No. He wanted me. He still wants me, but
he doesn't love you.
Of course he does, just...
Madrigal pauses.
Not like he loves her.
Well, so what? If he still cares for you...
Madrigal shakes her head. You don't understand.
She lays her palm flat against her stomach.
You are pregnant.
Yes. She looks down at her belly and smiles a little sadly.
Another Beltane begot, I think.
It seems I have a way with them.
Only this time I will not tell anyone that is what it is.
Because you want it to have a father, says Arsinoe. You want it to have Matthew. She purses her lips. All this time, using low magic, and still Madrigal does this, knowing the risks, knowing that there is always a price.
This will not go well for you, Arsinoe says.
It will be fine.
It will.
But you can't tell Jules, not until I'm ready. She will be happy eventually.
Jules loves babies.
She's not going to raise it for you, if that's what you're thinking, Arsinoe says. And Madrigal draws back as though slapped.
It was a cruel thing to say, but it was not without cause.
She looks at Madrigal's sash where the charm hides.
You should throw that away before it's too late. It is less a charm than a curse.
The bear is staring at the chickens when Arsinoe comes out. When he sees her, he rolls his head back and flaps his lower lip. And Camden tucks her tail and flattens her ears.
Do not do that, says Jules and touches her head. He's a friend now.
Camden, Camden, Arsinoe scolds. You won't forgive my bear for being a bear, but you forgive everyone else. I've seen the way you nuzzled Joseph, you furry little pushover.
Jules laughs and rubs the cat's back.
They walk together to the orchard. Two girls, a bear, and a cougar. Arsinoe's stomach is tight as a fist. The mask on her face is a comfort, and so is the poisoned blade in her vest. But she would still like to crawl into a hole and hide until morning.
Are they there yet? Arsinoe asks.
Yes.
How do they seem?
Rather like buffoons, Jules replies honestly. But remember that you thought the same of Billy when he first arrived.
Aye, but what are the chances of me being wrong twice?
She kicks at pebbles in the road, and Braddock swats at them like it is a game. It is hard to imagine that he is the same bear who tore apart those people on the quickening beach. But he is, and someday she will see those claws again, tearing someone open.
How are you, Jules? Are you all right?
I'm not going mad, if that's what you mean, Jules says.
That's not what I mean, it's just...
I'm fine, I don't feel strange or sick. Nothing's different.
Well, Arsinoe reasons, that's not exactly true.
Jules has started to push her war gift. Arsinoe knows she has. Jules has been spending too much time off by herself for it to mean anything else.
Will you show me?
I don't like it, Jules says.
Please?
I can understand having a gift that is a mystery to everyone around me. Sometimes I wonder what a poisoner I would be if I'd had the errands at my back.
You must wonder what you might have been like if you had been sent to the warriors in Bastion City.
I would only ever be a naturalist, Jules mutters. But she takes a deep breath and tenses her jaw, raising her arm toward the nearby trees. As Arsinoe watches, the branches of a maple begin to shake, as if from rowdy squirrels. Then the shaking stops.
That was you? Arsinoe asks.
I'm working on breaking off branches.
Save us time cutting wood for winter, Jules replies bitterly. Well, that will come in handy.
They say the war gifted can't float things anymore, that the mind mover part of the gift is gone.
I guess they were wrong.
The gifts grow strong all across the island. Before you know it, we'll be seeing great oracles again, and nothing will ever be a surprise. Arsinoe squints. I wonder what it all means.
Maybe that a great queen is coming, says Jules.
Maybe you. Rolanth. The day after the banquet, Joseph comes to Mirabella at Westwood House. Bree lets him into the drawing room in secret.
You earned an audience with her, Bree says, saving her like you did. But if you try something on behalf of the naturalist queen, I will skin you and your handsome suitor friend and send your bodies back on a barge.
Thank you, Joseph says, and Bree bows to Mirabella and leaves.
On a barge? He asks when they are alone.
A river barge, most likely. Mirabella's smile is tight-lipped. Nervous. This meeting is not like before. Joseph is well-dressed and composed, and the day is bright.
Then at least our bodies would enjoy some fine scenery on the way back to our families, he says, and she laughs.
What are you doing here? She asks.
In this house, or in Rolanth?
Both.
When he does not reply, she steps farther into the room, toward the windows.
Did you come to tell me to stay away from Arsinoe? To spare her?
But that would be a wasted trip, wouldn't it?
Then why? Mirabella holds her hands out to her sides.
This is not what I imagined when I imagined seeing you again. It is not the way we left things that night on the beach, when you saved me from her bear, and all I could think of was being parted from you.
Has it been so long? Since Beltane?
No,
he says softly.
It hasn't.
When I saw you with William Chatworth, with Billy, I wanted to run to you. I lay awake last night, thinking you might find a way to come. I waited.
She looks at him and he looks away.
But I suppose you were with him.
Not so far from my room, but with many locked doors and watchful Westwoods in between.
Mirabella.
I keep talking because I know that when I stop, it will be over.
That is what you have come to tell me.
I came to say goodbye.
Mirabella's throat tightens. Her eyes sting. But she is a queen. A broken heart must not show.
You chose her.
Because you could not have me? She would take that back the moment it leaves her lips. She hates the tone of it, the foolish hope.
I chose her because I love her. I have always loved her.
He is not lying, but it is not the whole truth. It is plain in the way he refuses to meet her eyes.
Words, she says.
You said you loved me as well once. You still want me, Joseph.
He does look at her finally, but what she sees in him is not lust, but guilt.
part of me may always, he says, and I will always care about what happens to you, but I choose Jules. As if there were a choice to make, she says. If there were, if there truly were, my choice would be the same. What happened between us was a mistake. I wasn't thinking. I didn't know where I was or who you were. And the night of the hunt? We both knew better then. Are you still going to tell me it was a mistake, an accident? Joseph lowers his head. That night was ecstasy, passion, a moment of peace amid the chaos of the festival. Desperation, he says. I wanted to be with Jules, but she refused me. I thought I'd lost her. Bitterness rises in her throat. Jules wants him and has him, and now she gloats. She cannot even leave Mirabella her memories. But that is not fair, Mirabella thinks, and closes her eyes. I have always known that I was the trespasser into their story. Why have you come to tell me this? She asks, and in her ears her voice sounds even and far away. I suppose I didn't want you to hope. I owed you that, didn't I? I couldn't just disappear, not after what happened. Very well, she says. I will not hope, if I ever did. I'm sorry, Mirabella. Do not apologize. I do not need it. When do you sail back for Wolf Spring? Tonight. She turns to him and smiles, her hands folded atop her skirt. Good. Sail safely, Joseph. He swallows. He has much more to say, but she will hear none of it. He takes his leave and the textured wallpaper of the drawing room wavers before her eyes. As his footsteps fade, Bree slips into the room and comes to take her in her arms. He chose her, Mirabella says. I knew that he would. He was hers before he was mine. I heard, Bree says softly. You were listening. Of course I was. Are you all right, Mira? Mirabella turns her head. If she went to the southward-facing windows, she could watch as he left. She could know if he ever looked back. I am fine, Bree. It is over. Bree sighs. No, she says. I saw the way he held you that night, Mira, and how he jumped in front of that bear. Half the island saw that. You are right. As a queen, it must be over for you. But anyone with eyes can see that for him, it never will be. Wolf Spring. The orchard is full when they arrive, and so bustling with activity that no one even notices the arrival of a great brown bear. There they are, Jules points. Two boys, both with red-gold hair, stand talking with Ellis and Madrigal. Madrigal flirts with them mercilessly. I hope they don't expect me to giggle like that, Arsinoe says. No one expects anyone to giggle like that, Jules replies, watching her mother with a sour expression. Which one is Tommy, and which is Michael? Tommy is the bigger of the two, Michael the more handsome. Jules, Arsinoe scolds. When Joseph gets back, I'm telling him. She squares her shoulders. The unpleasantness can no longer be put off. She reaches out to Braddock and pats him. He's calm, blinking curiously at the activity and the food piled high on the tables. Arsinoe takes a step toward the suitors and raises an arm in greeting, just as children come streaming out from between the trees. She falls in the midst of them, bowled over in the dirt as they squeal, caught up in a game of tag. Braddock grunts and joins in the fun. He rolls her back and forth on the ground. She rolls into chairs and upends them. Apples rain down like hail, and she covers her head as the bear lies down on top of her legs. Someone shouts, and Arsinoe quickly holds her palms up. No, no, Braddock. Back now, she says. She rolls onto her knees just in time to see Jules twist a knife
out of Tommy Stratford's hands. Enough, Braddock, enough! Arsinoe laughs and shoves his large brown head.
I'm sorry, Tommy says. I thought she was being attacked.
Michael Percy works up his courage and moves past Tommy to offer her his hand.
The bear's a lot to handle,
he says as he helps her to her feet.
How do you manage?
Sometimes I don't, as you've seen. She smiles at him, and his expression flickers. No doubt he remembers the carnage on the quickening stages. But the bear was not Braddock then. He was only a bear under a low magic spell, angry and frightened. Arsinoe slips her hand loose from Michael's. There is nothing wrong with accepting a suitor's helping hand. Only she cannot help wondering what Billy would say, and what he is doing in Roland, with her sister. Tommy approaches from her other side.
Are you all right?
He asks, speaking fast as if to cut off Michael's questions. If they keep up like that, she will be tired of them by the end of the day. Why have you chosen to pay court together? Arsinoe asks them. Sharing a barge for the disembarking was odd, but this is truly uncommon.
Competitiveness, Tommy says simply.
He grins and shows bright white teeth in a pleasantly handsome face. He is more sturdily built than Michael, but with their shared red-gold hair and similar features, looking at them is like viewing one through open air and another through a magnifying glass.
It's true. We've always been this way,
Michael cuts in. He bends to help Luke right an upended table. Arsinoe smiles apologetically, but Luke only winks. No one seems to mind the cleaning up. As long as she has her bear, she can do no wrong.
We're cousins, you see, Michael goes on. Go to the same schools, spend summers on each other's estates. When you spend so much time together, it's hard not to engage in one-upmanship. You must feel the same about the other queens, Tommy says.
It's not exactly the same when you have to kill them, says Arsinoe, and cranes her neck to look for jewels. Maybe she can take one of these boys off her hands. They were nearly as impressed by the sight of Camden as they were by Braddock. She looks back at Tommy, and he glances away. It takes her a moment to realize why. He had been trying to peek at what is underneath her mask. Arsinoe cannot decide whether to laugh or punch him. Why did you request first suit with me? She asks. Did you think I would die first? Michael shakes his head emphatically.
Not at all, he says. We just had to see the bear up close. We couldn't wait.
He gestures rather shyly toward Braddock lumbering ahead of them.
May I?
He asks.
I mean, is he safe?
If you feed him a fish, he will be perfectly safe. As the sun sets over the orchard and the braziers are lit for evening, Arsinoe and Jules stand back from the crowd. It is a good night. The children of Wolf Spring chase one another from hot brazier to hot brazier fearless. Folks sit at tables playing games and nibbling on leftover pie. Camden leans against Jules' legs, and Braddock lies somewhere in the dark, finally stuffed full of fish and apples, and tired of the children's shrieks. They aren't really so bad, Jules says. They could be much worse. I suppose so. Arsinoe cocks her head wearily. Tommy and Michael are at a table near the roasted suckling pigs, nodding and chuckling at something Luke is saying. Luke seems to like them. Don't be fooled, says Jules. He finds them tolerable. You know his heart is pledged to Billy nearly as solidly as yours is. As mine is? I don't remember making any pledges. Well, as soon as he gets back from Roland, maybe. Maybe, Arsinoe snorts and crosses her arms. Her heart skips. Her knife is no longer in her vest. Jules, my knife is gone. She pats herself all over, as if it might have moved to another pocket by itself. It probably fell out when you were tussling with Braddock, Jules says. We can find it tomorrow, in the daylight. No, you don't understand. Arsinoe looks quickly over the people in attendance. Her people, talking and drinking. Luke calls to Tommy and Michael from the edge of the nearest row of apple trees, and they get up to play a shadow game with the children. Before he goes, Tommy slices another serving of meat and eats it, and Arsinoe's heart stops at the sight. He used her knife. The whole table had. Her knife, with the poisoned edge.
Oh, goddess,
she whispers and runs to the table to pick it up. Arsinoe, what's wrong? Jules asks, running up behind her.
They used my knife. The knife I dropped.
It takes Jules a moment to understand. To her, Arsinoe is still not a poisoner. Who was eating here? She asks.
Both of the suitors? I don't know who else. We have to send for a healer, Jules, now!
Arsinoe moves to bolt, but Jules holds her fast.
Send for a healer and say what? That our poisoner in disguise accidentally poisoned her own suitors? You can't!
Arsinoe blinks.
What are you saying? That doesn't matter now. They need help.
Arsinoe, no. She has grasped onto Arsinoe's arm with a grip like iron when they hear the first cry.
Poison! Luke shouts. Poison! Send for the healers! The suitors have been poisoned!
No,
Arsinoe whispers miserably, but Jules holds her fast and takes the knife to slide into her back pocket.
You did not mean to do this, Jules hisses fiercely. This is not your fault, and it's too late to help them now.
Greavesdrake Manor.
Poison the suitors? I did no such thing, Catarine declares. Why would I poison them before I even got to meet them?
She crosses her arms and turns her back to the tall windows in Natalia's study.
Because they chose your sister, Genevieve says. Because she had two to your one. Because you could.
Genevieve crosses her arms as well, and Natalia rubs her temples with tired fingers.
Stop sniping at each other like spoiled children, she mutters.
Well, she has truly made a mess of this, Genevieve half shouts. Returning from the dead is one thing, but murdering mainland suitors?
She throws up her hands.
I did not do it, I said, Catarine shouts back. Natalia, I did not.
Whether you did or did not does not matter. They are dead. And if you did not do it, then someone did it on your behalf. So, what do we do now?
Natalia steadies her nerves with another sip of brandy tainted with you. Except that she has already had too much, and her mind is sluggish when it should be sharp. She looks at her glass and then drains it anyway.
It could be worse, she says.
The suitors will have families to appease, but once we would have had whole countries. We will not go to war over this.
Think of the money it will take, Genevieve grumbles. The resources and favors. She will bankrupt the crown before she even wears it.
At least they were cousins, so it is only one family to appease and not two, Catarine mutters. And Natalia reprimands her with an arched brow.
The island will not like this, Genevieve paces.
When she stops, her whole body bounces with the motion of her tapping foot.
Word is spreading. The suitors were not the only ones to die. An old man and a little girl in Wolf Spring also fell to the poison. And this, amid the talk of farmers dying in wildfires and lightning-struck cattle, this ascension is going out of control.
She points at Catarine.
If you would just poison like Queen Camille did, or Queen Nicola, fast and clean. Poisons that found their targets and no one else.
Genevieve, be quiet, Natalia says.
How a queen poisons is a queen's business. Issue a statement from the council. Remind the people that the greatest ascensions are bloody and turbulent. That is when the strongest queens rise.
Suitors die. It is known.
If they had still been alive for the Beltane crowning, they may have died in the Innisfool woods during the hunt of the stags.
It is still a mess, Genevieve says,
but she says so more softly.
Natalia, Catarine says,
I really did not...
Natalia waves her hand. Whether you did or did not, we must find a way out of it. She stands up and walks from behind her desk to look out the windows at the great city of Indrid down across the hills. Those suitors did not matter anyway. Our alliance with the Chatworth boy's father still holds. Chatworth has gone to great lengths to insinuate himself into the trust of the Westwoods, in case we have need of him, and the boy will make a fine king consort when the time comes.
Can we not get him away from my sister? Catherine asks. I do not like him standing between us. I want to go to her. I would look her in the eye when I carve up her pretty face with a poisoned blade.
She walks to Natalia's decanter of brandy and pours herself a measure, then drinks it in one large gulp.
You take poison now at every meal, Genevieve says. How do you know?
The servants talk. They say that you sicken long into the night, that you take too much and will do yourself harm. But Catherine only laughs.
Have they not heard? She asks. You cannot kill what is already dead.
Natalia frowns. Rumors of the undead queen have not faded as they hoped. Instead, they grow stronger, and Catherine is not helping the people to forget.
Cat, Natalia asks thoughtfully, would you really like to go to Mirabella?
Catherine and Genevieve look at her curiously.
With the temple inspecting everything, it would be easier if you were face to face, Natalia says.
So what if we put you together? Put you all together, for the Midsummer Festival.
It is barely 2 weeks away.
We could descend upon Wolf Spring.
Perfect, says Genevieve. Whatever damage is done to Wolf Spring from the Queen's business will be penance for failing to protect the suitors. But High Priestess Luca will not like it.
Who cares what she likes and does not like? Catherine says. If it were up to you, I would do nothing until Beltane was over, and the three of us would end up locked in the tower. I do not like to think of how I would fare trapped in close quarters with a bear.
Besides, Natalia says, I think the High Priestess would force her queen's hand as well. None were happy when Mirabella returned from the Ashburn Woods with Arsinoe still alive. If we offer to hold the festival of the Reaping Moon in Roland afterward, I do not think she will object to Midsummer.
I will discuss it with the council at once.
Genevieve half curtsies and then walks toward the door.
Wait, says Natalia. Let me send a letter to Luca first.
Perhaps we can save ourselves an argument.
Rolandth. Billy has ordered a table set for two in the sunlit grounds behind Westwood House. It is a pretty table, with a bright white tablecloth and silver platters. But as Mirabella sits, the sun glints off one and nearly blinds her. So she calls some clouds, and soon the sky is filled with thunderheads.
"What's the point of dining outside?" Billy asks. "If you wanted shade, I could have had the table moved underneath the trees."
"I will not let them rain," Mirabella says, as he presses his lips together crossly. He has warmed to Bree and to Sarah, and of course he could not resist Elizabeth. But when Mirabella speaks, he barely listens. Much of his time is spent in the city with Bree and her glassmaking apprentice, and when he is not there, he is with Elizabeth at the temple, fascinated by the white-robed priestesses and their black tattooed bracelets. Mirabella clears her throat and turns toward the cart of food. Fortunately, he is a good taster, taking complete control of the kitchen. Unfortunately, he is a horrible cook.
What have you brought for us today?
Pork stew, he says, with spoon bread for dipping and for dessert, a baked strawberry tart with cream.
You are becoming quite skilled, she says, and smiles.
Lying is a waste when you know I have to taste it.
He serves them both. The stew looks thin and strangely pale. A sheen of grease has collected on the surface. He uses her fork and knife to sample everything on her plate, and waits in silence to see if he will fall over or froth at the mouth,
I don't know why I bother, he says. The priestess is there. He gestures into the shadows of the house. They watched